This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, everyone. We're talking about sex education today. And the different views of the different political parties, the Alliance Party, the DUP, very much fundamentally different views about what should be taught in schools about sex. And then a cracker week story about, you know, the baggage things that they have, that if you're taking hand baggage onto the planes and the wee sizer things they have, one of our listeners has kicked it all off. She brings a measuring tape with her everywhere. Have a listen. It's good.
The Stephen Nolan Show.
Good morning. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. 9:05, the Nolan Show from the BBC. The Alliance Party are calling for standardised, age-appropriate information in schools. And this has very much instigated a heated debate in the Assembly, which we will get into in a moment or two. The motion that was brought to the floor by the Alliance Party was for compulsory, standardised, inclusive, high-quality, evidence-based and age-appropriate education in schools right across Northern Ireland. There are some politicians saying what that's doing is taking away choice from school governors and principals and parents. And we'll get your views on this morning. Something needs to be done, says the Alliance Party. During the debate in the Assembly Chamber, the Alliance MLA Owen Tennyson spoke of his experience in school regarding relationships and sex education.
We had a facilitator come in who did try, in fairness, to administer some level of fact-based or SE. And there was one fleeting reference to same-sex couples, which was met by laughter from teachers and pupils in the school. Can you imagine how that feels to be a young person, struggling with internalised homophobia, scared to tell your parents and relatives and friends who you are, to have your sexuality laughed at in a public forum? That is not good enough. Members, it is not good enough, and it is incumbent on all of us in this chamber to change it. A number of assertions have been made, and I've taken note of a few of them. I would say, first of all, that my experience was indoctrination. It was not education. I was not given all of the information I needed to be able to make an informed choice in line with my own ethical values. Someone else's ethical values were imposed upon me.
Well, Owen Tennyson is with us this morning. Good morning, Owen.
Good morning, Stephen.
How was it indoctrination? Can you expand on that?
Well, earlier in my speech, Stephen, I mean, I spoke about two occasions in which OSE was delivered in my school. And the first occasion that I mentioned in my speech was an occasion whereby a religious figure was brought into the school to effectively teach abstinence and to tell us that the only way to keep ourselves safe was to reserve sex until marriage. And that is, in my view, indoctrination rather than education. It wasn't giving us all of the information about all of the choices that were available to us. It wasn't equipping us with skills and information that we needed in order to live happy, healthy lives and keep ourselves safe and free from harm. It didn't deal adequately with issues around coercive behaviour, contraception, and all of those things that affect too many people in society, unfortunately. And so that was my point, that effectively by imposing moral views on children and presenting that as relationship and sex education simply isn't good enough. It's absolutely fine for schools, in accordance with their own ethos, to talk about the different choices that face young people and to talk about church teaching. But to present that as objective education in the context of OSE, I don't believe it's good enough, to put it quite simply.
And you said there was one fleeting reference to gay people. You're an openly gay man. Are you suggesting you were laughed at by the class?
Yeah, there was a fleeting reference to something, I can't remember exactly what it was, but there was a fleeting reference to, and this would also apply to same-sex couples, and it was met with laughter by the people in the lecture hall and by other teachers who were present in the hall as well.
How old were you?
And that was, I was 14 or 15 at the time.
How did you feel when that happened?
I felt humiliated. I felt absolutely humiliated. And my point, Stephen, is when we talk about RSE in schools, because I'm conscious that, that this isn't about me, this is about our young people who are coming up behind me and who are in the education system today. We have a system whereby choices are made by governors in accordance with the ethos of individual schools about the RSE curriculum and how it's delivered. Now, there are some schools out there who do an absolutely fantastic job and who are examples of best practice in terms of how they approach this issue. But there are other schools who do fall short, and we know this from speaking to young people themselves who, when surveyed, consistently tell us that the information that they're getting is not adequate. And all our motion sought to do was seek for the Minister and for the Department of Education to take a proactive approach to ensure some level of standardisation so that it's not a postcode lottery in terms of the quality of education that children are getting. And unfortunately, the Minister and the DUP more broadly sought to turn this into a party political issue, throw personal insults at me and attack my party, rather than engage, I think, seriously with the substance of the issue. And that's hugely regrettable.
Well, you say that. And look, the personal insults we will that you're alleging, we will talk about in a moment. But the flip side of this is, you're saying that some boards of governors and some schools are falling short. Maybe they're not falling short. Maybe they're just making their decisions as to how their schools should be run in a democratic process where there are boards of governors and parents and school principals that may want the education to be different to you.
Well, Stephen,
and your party is trying to take that choice away from those schools.
We live in a democratic society, and ultimately the Department for Education has ultimate responsibility for education. And when we talk about this issue, I mean, I don't understand why we treat RSE differently to other subjects, because other subjects are standardised, be it English or maths. I mean, can you imagine a situation, Stephen, where the science curriculum was allowed to be outsourced to a religious organisation who refused to teach those pupils about the theory of evolution? None of us would stand for it. And that is why standardisation in this area of RSE is so important. It is difficult. It is complicated. There are competing rights that have to be considered. There are parents out there who have genuine concerns, which I think we do need to engage with and address. I accept all of that. But just because it is difficult doesn't mean the minister should shirk responsibility and simply push this onto schools and governors without appropriate support. There needs to be standardisation, and he needs to engage seriously with young people themselves to understand what they need. Because the world is changing. It is more complicated. There are huge amounts of misinformation out there online. There are issues around pornography being readily available to young people at a scarily young age. And we need to ensure that those young people are getting the information that they need from a trusted and reliable source, rather than exposing them to that kind of misinformation online.
So how would it work if Alliance get their way and there is standardisation of the education in schools and boards of governors do not have that discretion for a particular school where there is a particular religious ethos? Would that school have to teach against its religious ethos?
Well, no, because the information can be provided in an impartial way. The school is very free to say, here are your rights, here are your responsibilities, here are the options that are available to you. The religious teaching is this. However, it's for you to make a choice in line with your own ethical values. It's about ensuring that it is an education, that it gives information, it gives children the information they need to make their own informed choices in line with their own moral compass, rather than having that imposed upon them. And the reality is, Stephen, that in many of our schools, right across the sectors of the education system, there is diversity in terms of those young people there. Those young people will come from different kinds of families. Those young people will come from different faiths and none. Those children will have different sexualities.
But the parents have chosen to send them to a particular school because of the rules, the ethos, the decisions that are in that school made by the boards of governors and principals. And you want to homogenise that all into some central role that one education minister decides.
Each of those children has a right to the proper, adequate information, regardless of the sector that they're educated in. And look, we had a debate yesterday, Stephen, about the balance between parental rights and children's rights. And there is a balance to be struck. I absolutely accept that. But there's a crucial point in this, because when the DUP talk about the fact that the family unit is sacrosanct, well, let's talk about that. The reality is, unfortunately and tragically, that the family unit is one of the most common environments for abuse. And so there have been examples, and colleagues, Neil McAllister spoke about it yesterday in the debate, are aware of examples whereby children who are victims have been removed from OSE by abusers so that the children aren't equipped with the information that they need to report the abuse. And there is an obligation, actually, on the state to step in those cases. Just like we have the Department of Children's and Social Services, we have an obligation as a state to ensure children are protected through our education system.
So what is it about what the DUP is proposing that you think is not to the benefit of children?
They're not proposing anything. They're proposing to keep a system which we know currently isn't functioning as well as it should.
But how is it exactly not functioning? What is a child deprived of if the DUP get their way?
Well, I've given you the example, Stephen, where you can have some schools given fact-based comprehensive OSE and other schools teaching that through a particular ethos in a way that isn't comprehensive and fact-based. And currently there isn't sufficient monitoring, there isn't sufficient guidance, there isn't sufficient training to ensure that every child, regardless of what school they attend, is getting high-quality OSE. I don't think that should be a controversial concept. In fact, when you speak to most people out there, I think most people see the benefit in terms of that standardisation. But instead, the DUP have decided to weaponise and misrepresent the issue for party political purposes, which I think is hugely regretful when we're talking about children and young people.
So what would a school be mandated to teach about trans people?
Well, Stephen, this is a red herring, actually, that was raised in the debate yesterday, because the only people that were talking about gender identity were the DUP. In terms of the motion itself, we weren't prescriptive in terms of the curriculum.
Yeah, but I'm not the DUP, but I'm asking the question, not the DUP. So there are people who are very concerned, as you know, about children, for example, it's a live current debate. The Conservative Party has commented on it. The government has commented on it. There's a report that's out just a few days ago around children who have had medical treatment, puberty blockers at such a young age. So what would a school be mandated to teach to a child about trans issues, including whether a biological male is always a male or not?
Well, if you'd allow me to finish, Stephen, the motion that we tabled in the Assembly yesterday deliberately wasn't prescriptive, because we think there is a wider piece of engagement that needs to happen, led by the Department in terms of public consultation with parents and children and young people, to develop a curriculum that is appropriate. If you're asking for my view, I mean...
Has your party a settled position on it, Owen, is what I'm asking?
Well, we have a settled position on the principles. We haven't got a settled position in terms of step-by-step in every year of the curriculum exactly what would be taught, because that is the Department for Education's job.
But has the Alliance Party got a position on puberty blockers being given to children?
Well, we have always said, Stephen, and I don't understand how this is relevant to RSE, but I'll answer the question given that it's been asked. My position on this, and I'm on the public record saying this, is that this issue should always be led by clinicians and clinical advice in conjunction with young people and their families. I don't get myself involved in other medical decisions that other people take, and I'm not going to start doing it for trans people.
Okay.
It is the clinicians who have the best evidence and the best ability to advise on the way forward in that regard, and it's not something that I think most schools are routinely talking about, if I'm honest, Stephen.
It got very, very heated in the Assembly yesterday. The Belfast Telegraph is reporting that there are now calls for a probe into Paul Given's remark, a remark that he made during the debate. This is when you were talking about how you felt you were indoctrinated at school, as you've explained today. And Sinn Féin are alleging that they heard the minister say, well, it clearly didn't work. Did you hear it?
No, I didn't, because I was speaking at the time, so I'm not aware exactly what the minister said. I'm grateful, however, to Emma Sheeran for flagging the issue, because I think it's important. If the minister did make a glib and churlish remark at that point in the debate, then I think that raises serious concerns about his ability to deliver an education system that accommodates people from right across our community. And I think he needs to reflect on that. I think he needs to clarify.
Well, it depends what he meant, doesn't
it? If he did say it, he needs to apologise.
Well, it depends. Well, does he need to apologise? Because that comment can mean a whole different range of things. You weren't indoctrinated, were you? Is he not right? You grew up to be a confident, young man, openly gay, proud of yourself. Clearly it didn't work, that indoctrination.
After many years, Stephen, of internal strife, which is a sad reality for too many LGBT people, I would have come out at a much younger age and been much happier at a much earlier stage in my life had I not dealt with some of the attitudes within our school system. And if the minister is making light of that, if the minister is making glib remarks and jokes about that in the chamber, I think he seriously needs to reflect.
But you don't know that he
is. It wasn't the only remark. Well, I was in the debate, Stephen, and I know what the tone of the debate from the minister and the DUP was. And it was nothing more than personal insult, conjecture, misinformation, and personal attack.
Well, the minister,
and I think that is below, actually.
Well, Paul,
elected member in that chamber.
Paul Given would very much deny any personal insult. Jonathan Buckley from the DUP is with us this morning. Was anyone from your party throwing personal insults at Owen Tennyson, Jonathan?
Well, good morning, Stephen. I think this is a huge diversion tactic from the Alliance Party this morning to take attention away from actually what they were trying to achieve in their motion. I detected no personal slurs towards Mr. Tennyson, but what I did take exception from was that before the debate had even started, Owen Tennyson actually made a direct slur to over 600 people in my constituency, including myself, when he branded an event in which I hosted as far right. In fact, I think it was a dog whistle to the far right was the language that he used. Now, if Mr. Tennyson wants to get into whether or not that's appropriate, rather than the minister's comments, and I think you've outlined the minister's position quite clearly, which was when Mr. Tennyson indicated that he was there was an attempt to indoctrinate him at his school. I don't know the school, I don't know the organisation, so I don't want to unfairly categorise that school or that organisation. But the minister was right. Clearly it didn't work. Mr. Tennyson was not indoctrinated because he was in the assembly articulating a very different point to what the supposed indoctrination was. So I think that's a side point. I think getting back to the substance was that anybody that was watching on in yesterday's debate, and in fact I've had quite a few parents alarmed that have been in touch, were taken aback, in fact some aghast, at just the sneering and nasty tone from many of the Alliance front bench, who wanted to dismiss not only parents' concerns, but indeed teachers' concerns for the direction of travel that the Alliance Party want to go with RSE. And I think Owen actually...
What's wrong with the direction they want to go?
Well, Stephen, in terms of the motion that they presented to the Assembly today, it was vague. So that led the question, what does standardise mean? The DUP took the approach that we believe in academic freedom within the grounds of school ethos. We have a proud tradition of schools in our being at the centre of our community, and they reflect very much the communities that they belong to. And they have some very, very successful stories of where they have nurtured young people, counselled them through some of the most difficult periods of their life, and prepared them for life.
So do you believe that a school has a right to tell a pupil that it's wrong to have sex before marriage?
I'm not saying that the school has adopted that position.
No. Does a school, in your view, when you believe in the freedom of a school to make their own decisions, does a school, according to the DUP, have a right to instruct as education to children that they should not have sex before marriage?
Well, the DUP is not actually being prescriptive on it, Stephen. It is up to the individual school to... Hold on. This is the factual position. It is up to the individual school, in line with their board of governors,
so?
to put in place an RSE policy that meets the need. And in fact, RSE is actually inspected, reviewed, and monitored by the individual.
So therefore, Jonathan, what you're saying is, it's up to the school. Therefore, a school does have a right to instruct as education, do not have sex before marriage. Therefore, a school does have a right, does it, to say to a child, gay sex is wrong.
I don't believe that.
Because a board of governors has a right to do anything that they collectively decide to do.
The board of governors have a responsibility to engage with their school teachers and indeed set out an RSE policy that is clear, informative and prepares people for future life. And the point with the motion was that I found most misunderstanding in terms of its content. Why were the Alliance Party not more prescriptive in what they wanted to see with RSE? Because the recent Relationships and Sexuality Education consultation, which was carried out by the department, showed that of the thousands that responded, 73% disagreed with changes to RSE. So that led the question, Stephen, what did the Alliance mean by compulsory, standardised, evidence-based?
Well, you can answer that.
There are a number of things. I mean, first of all, that was a consultation on regulations led by the Secretary of State. It was not a consultation, to be clear, on the contents of our motion. And actually, when you dig beneath the number of consultation responses that were submitted, I understand that less than 1% of those were actually children and young people themselves. And I think Johnny has actually laid out my argument very clearly for me, in that because there is no prescriptive approach, because there is no standardisation across the piece, schools do have freedom to teach practically whatever they want in accordance with ethos. And I don't think that that is acceptable. And I think this is where me and Johnny differ. His approach allows those harmful practices, in my view, to continue unchecked. Would challenge them. That was the intent of the motion.
But when I would say, when you say that I believe in harmful practices continue, I'm still unclear as to where the Alliance Party's position is, because it seems to be that it is the Alliance that are weaponizing children in the culture war. I've heard no principals calling for change, only actually cultural activists. And when we look at, for example,
I am
listening to young people, and I think you and the Alliance Party believe that you have a monopoly on what young people think. Let's get to the reality here. Stephen Farry was on record as saying that, for example, the Scottish gender bill that will hopefully come to effect to Northern Ireland. Is this something that's endorsed by the Alliance Party under proposed RSE changes? What would be the Alliance Party's position in terms of teaching of biological gender identities? These are huge questions, Owen, that, to be honest with you, your motion may not have addressed, but indeed some of your members have addressed at times past. Whenever the Department of Education released their consultation RSE, your party member, Connie Aiken, said that the experiences within schools have been too heteronormative. What does that actually mean, Owen?
It means that many gay people within schools have been ostracised and not appropriately treated, Johnny, as you well know. And Stephen, I'm frankly not...
But what does it mean within biological identity, Owen?
I need to respond to that. Because we are met with these red herrings every time we try.
They're not red herrings.
We're going to let him finish, Jonathan.
We're met with these red herrings about legislation in Scotland and misinformation about what would be in the RSE curriculum. And Johnny has, I think, weaponized trans people in the debate yesterday, and he's tried to do it again this morning in a way that is really unhelpful. I think it is important that we tread lightly on these issues, because when we are talking about gender identity, we are talking about a very small number of very vulnerable people in our community. The DUP, I think, has regret over the way in which it spoke about gay people in the past and the damage that they caused and the lives that were lost because of the toxic culture that they created. And I would plead, Johnny, don't do it again with another marginalised group. Don't point score off the back of another marginalised group. These are complicated issues that we need to resolve, that we need to explore in more detail. It's not going to be resolved between you and I on this show today. It does need serious engagement in a respectful and dignified way. But this pathetic party political points scoring off the back of marginalised communities has to stop.
Well, Jonathan, you will want to respond to that.
Yeah, yes, I will, Stephen, because I think it's clear to anybody that, you know, these are really complex issues. In fact, in many instances, quite disturbing for many parents who believe that there is an attempt now to push ideology down their throats and down the throats of their children in school. And, you know, Owen may want to characterise myself or indeed those that believe and have concerns as far right.
I didn't.
But I can... You did, Owen. Let me finish.
I'm going to help here, you both, rather than speculate. We've actually got a clip of what was said yesterday. Let's have a listen to what Owen actually said.
I want to return to my own comments about a dog whistle to the far right. And I think we have heard a very strong dog whistle to the far right from Mr. Buckley here today. So I stand by my remarks. I stand by my remarks because, no, it is not parents. And I want to be clear about this. I want to be clear about this. I believe that the DUP has engaged in a dog whistle to the far right. There are many parents out there with legitimate concerns and questions which I believe can be assuaged and addressed. But instead, the DUP choose to capitalise on that fear.
To the far right, Owen? Do you really believe that?
Well, Stephen, if you look at my Twitter mention over the past 24 hours, you will see very good examples of responses from far-right activists to some of the misinformation that the DUP have peddled. So the evidence is there if Johnny wishes to go and look at it.
Stephen, I would just like to say I understand that the Speaker is reviewing the remarks by Owen Tennyson in the Chamber directed towards me, and I do take it as a personal insult. The far right is associated with Adolf Hitler, a man that gassed millions of Jews. How does Owen think that not only I, but I'm serious when I say this, the people that engaged in the meeting in Portadown were parents, were teachers, were principals, were lecturers at Stranmillers College. I think it's absolutely beyond reproach what Owen Tennyson has said about those people. And I'm going to clarify this point. Anybody that disagrees with the Alliance Party's position on gender ideology is automatically branded to the far right. They're not. They have legitimate concerns. And I'm going to voice them, Stephen, and I'm not going to be silenced just because Owen Tennyson and some of his frontbench colleagues in the Alliance Party want to characterise me in any way that they see fit. I'll stand up for those parents and I'm not going to be silenced on the issue.
Owen?
Well, Stephen, I think it's very clear from my remarks in the Chamber exactly what I was referring to. It is, I believe, a far-right tactic to spread misinformation and to play on the back of minority communities. And that is what Johnny is doing. I was not, and I want to be clear about this again today, I was not talking about parents out there who have genuine concerns about their children and what they're being taught in school and the curriculum. As I said, I believe if those parents are given proper information about what the curriculum entails, if they're communicated with appropriately and in a measured way, rather than what Johnny is doing, then fanning the flames and playing on that fear and division and offering nothing more than hate and prejudice to the debate. I think that is fanning the flames. And I am committed to working with those parents who have concerns to address them and to ensure that we have an RSE curriculum.
But because he has a different opinion to you does not mean that he's offering hate and prejudice.
It's not just that he has a different opinion. It's his style of debate and the way in which he weaponizes minority communities in the debate, which I think is inappropriate.
Sorry, Stephen, is Owen for real here? Is Owen actually for real here? I think anybody that wants to reflect on yesterday's debate, it should be Owen Tennyson and his Alliance colleagues. To call people far right is a serious allegation, Owen. And you have no desire here in this programme, even post debate, to apologise. You're better than that.
I'll give you an example. Tom Elliott of the Ulster Unionists opposed the motion yesterday. Tom did that in a respectful and a measured way. So there's a reason, Johnny, why the allegation was only lobbied at you and not at others.
So the allegation of far right... Listen, Stephen, I have to go, the public won't be taken for fools in this. At a time when education is facing all sorts of pressures, childcare pressures, special educational needs pressures, and the attempt from the Alliance Party is to strip away parental rights, I think the Alliance Party really have a lot of questions on this, and it will continue.
And he is saying dog whistle to the far right. He is not accusing you of being in the far right, Jonathan.
Dog whistle. So he's now describing the 600 people as dogs. In fact, that they're going to be marched into
Johnny,
a room because I blew a whistle. Owen,
You're extrapolating a remark and misappropriating it.
Can I also establish, you've said, Jonathan, that you believe that the speaker is looking at these remarks. Is the speaker also, because you will be aware of the view of the Education Minister, Paul Given, given what he is alleged to have said, is the speaker looking at Mr. Given's comments as well?
I'm not aware of that, Stephen. The reason why I say that I know that the Speaker's investigating Mr. Tennyson's remarks is there was a direct point of order in which he said that he would be reviewing the content of Mr. Tennyson's speech. I think maybe he did say the same in relation to a point of order to the Education Minister, so I'd imagine we may hear that address.
Do you think that Paul Given, the Minister's alleged comments, need to be investigated on?
I think they should, and as I said, I'm grateful to Emma Sheeran from Sinn Féin, who actually spotted the comments and raised the point of order. And my understanding is that the Speaker is looking at those remarks.
Okay. Where does this go from here, finally, Owen? Where does it go from here?
Well, unfortunately, the Minister hasn't indicated that he wants to take this issue anywhere, and I think that is hugely regrettable. I think if we spent less time focused on fringe issues and more time actually working together, talking about how we can approach this issue in a measured way and get to an outcome that is satisfactory for everyone, we would be in a better place. But it doesn't seem that the DUP are going to entertain that. And I understand that there are elections coming up later in the year, and it's been a difficult time for the DUP, and the priority is political pot shots. That's unfortunate, but Alliance will continue to campaign on this issue until we secure the change that children and young people so desire.
Final word to you, Jonathan.
Yeah, it's nothing but a political pot shot from the Alliance Party, actually, when we reflect upon your comments. I think we have an Education Minister that is fully aware of what the Alliance Party's agenda is here and their attempt to weaponise children in their culture war. So I think what we're going to continue to see is an Education Minister that is very alive to those concerns. There is a minimum curriculum contact on RSE at present, and schools have the flexibility on how that's delivered. And I have no doubt that the Minister will continue to keep a watch upon the ever encroach from the Alliance Party on these very, very difficult and disturbing issues trying to place upon our children.
Okay. Owen Tennyson, Jonathan Buckley, thank you very much indeed. Well, we're getting a real sense there of a fundamental difference of opinion between those two big parties. 0303 80 55 55. Susan, you're a teacher. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
I'm okay, thank you. You're a secondary school teacher?
Yes, I am.
So what's your view? Thanks for calling us.
Well, I think I was concerned really about the outworkings of this, really. Yes, I think that RSE, you know, should be delivered, but I'm not so sure that teachers are best placed to deliver this. I mean, if we look at the curriculum as it stands, teachers are overloaded, they're overworked, and we are subject specific. I have a master's in English literature, and I don't think that I would be the best person to deliver RSE because simply I'm not trained in it, nor are my colleagues. None of us are trained in it, and it's just a tag on. And I suppose on top of that, serious issue.
But so who does teach it?
Everybody, all teachers are expected to teach it. Usually it's
but
down
who
to the
should teach
tutor.
It?
Well, my view is that it should be outsourced, possibly to professional trained bodies who can, because if you are going to teach such a sensitive subject, you're working in a very, I suppose, a different landscape in terms of the classroom that we would have been doing about 20 years ago. It's a more litigious landscape. You leave yourself open to parental complaints, complaints from Board of Governors, depending if you're working in a religious school or not.
But if it was standardised, if the Alliance motion carried and it was standardised and spelt out what it was your job to do, not your choice to do, what exactly you should be teaching, and you didn't have the discretion, would that not make it easy for you? because you're simply doing your job. You're not making a choice, nor would the Board of Governors be making a choice what part, what subjective education to give to a child around sex.
Well, I'm not sure, but still, because you're still dealing with the sensitive issue of relationship and sexual education,
yeah.
And people have particular agendas on that. You are dealing with a range of children in the classroom now that would not have been there, you know, 20 years
ago. Well, they would have been there. They just might not have had
the ability,
freedom to be themselves.
And it's great that they have that freedom. But I think that you are now working in, like, a minefield. I mean, I am qualified as an English teacher, and I am not qualified as an RSE. And I think that to deliver any subject, you need to be a specialist in that subject.
Susan,
and
go ahead, finish your point, of course.
I do think that, you know, if teachers do put a foot wrong in the classroom when they are delivering this, they could have a range of complaints against them, be put through disciplinary procedures. It is a minefield. And I did say in my text to you, it was like getting a plumber to come in and do your electrics if you're asking perhaps a technology teacher, an English teacher to deliver RSE. I think kids deserve more as well.
Susan, thank you. 03030805555. Mary in the Bogside. Morning, Mary.
Hiya. Susan's 100%. I actually qualified in counselling myself, but these teachers, they should not be bombarded. We should teach children emotional intelligence, prepare them for life, educate them in a way that they understand, not bring in sexual things. And they're not prepared for that. They're young and they're innocent and they're naive. But you could teach them how to be strong and how to build their life and be confident and financially get the education or get a job and just prepare them for life. I've done that with my grandchildren and they are so tuned in and well educated. And that's the way. Now they make their own decisions. I won't force them. I have nothing to do with that. I just made sure that they were safe, secure, and know where they're going.
Michael in Newton Ards next. Morning, Michael.
Good morning, Stephen. Just a thought. Why don't we just throw religious education out of school and then no one can be blamed on an attempt to indoctrinate any kids and just let them make their own mind up?
Well, what do you mean? Should the teaching be standardised, though?
So what does society gain from religious activity being taught in schools? What gain to society
Why do you think we have so many people who feel that schools with a religious ethos have a lot to gain children and their parents and society? That's why we have them.
Popularity is no measure of merit, Stephen, but it's because a lot of people think it doesn't make it right. If there was no education in school, then there'd be none of this discussion.
You don't think there should be any sex education in school?
No, sorry, I'm talking about religious.
Okay,
the sex thing, Stephen, that lady was talking about kids being naive and stuff. And if you're to believe anything in the media about how many kids under 12 are on hardcore porn sites, I think a naivety's long gone.
Sorry, you're confused. Because a child has access at a very young age to pornography does not mean that pornography is educating them, for goodness sake.
Correct. No, that's what I'm saying. It's not, Stephen. So the naivety's gone.
No, the naivety's not gone. They could be watching this pornography and be totally naive as to the true meaning of sex, the love that is associated with a sexual relationship, the damage that can be done to you by inappropriate fascination with sex. Of course there's naivety with children under 12. Come on. What are you saying to me?
Aren't naive is what you're trying to make out. Apart from the naivety and the sex, that's the religious that I'm worried about. Why? What benefit does religious education bring to society? You tell me the benefit.
But I'm asking you about, do you think the children should be taught about sex in school?
Stephen, my point was religious education. I don't think it should be taught about sex in school, no.
So who should teach them?
Themselves, Stephen.
Themselves?
There's no experience like experience, Stephen.
So you want a child to have made the mistakes and without any education be out there on their own?
Their parents will provide them with anything they need, Stephen.
You think parents, lots of parents can interact with young children about
that's
sex?
That's their job, Stephen. Not 6 hours a day in school, mate. on one or two periods a week on sex education and religious education. Their parents can provide that for them. And you still haven't attributed any benefit to religious education in society, Stephen. What is the benefit of it?
Well, what is the benefit? It's not for me to do. I'm sure others very well might.
Why it's not, Stephen, because there is no benefit, none whatsoever. Mad religion was kicked out of schools.
Michael, thank you. Good morning. 030-30-80-55-55. Orla in Belfast. Morning, Orla.
Hello, good morning.
Orla, I'm only back from that lovely, calm beach in California. And 2 days in a row now I'm screaming.
Voice must be sore.
It is.
I just wanted to say, I agree with what the teacher was saying earlier on, that there should be a standardised curriculum, but it also should align with the school's ethos in a certain way. So I do feel, I agree with her with what she was saying, that it should be outsourced. I went to school, I left school about 6-7 years ago now, and I felt that our education was extremely out of touch. Now, I went to an all-girls Catholic grammar school. So, of course, abstinence and sex before marriage, no sex before marriage was going to be the, you know, the main point of the ethos of the school. But I was sitting in an assembly at 18 years of age where we were being taught that the only choice was no sex before marriage, complete abstinence. And I'm looking around the school assembly hall and there's at least 7 or 8 girls who are either pregnant or have a child at home.
What?
So I understand that the education has to align with the school's ethos, but even down to the curriculum, never mind the assemblies we were given. Whenever I was studying GCSE religion, ethics was a main point of the curriculum, and our teacher point blank refused to teach us anything about sex education. She handed us a notebook, told us to read it ourselves, and left, and refused to touch base on anything that wasn't no sex before marriage.
Your teacher actually refused to in any way engage with it herself, wouldn't even read out the text.
Wouldn't even read it out. She gave us a workbook and told us over the course of 2 weeks to do it ourselves. Now, she did touch base on the contraception in terms of only having sex in certain times of the month, but that was it. There was no talk about STIs. There was no talk about ethics in relationships. She said, and I quote, "It is an adult issue and you guys shouldn't be worrying about it," even though we were 17 and 18.
And do you think that was down to her religious conviction? Do you think that was down to her embarrassment or feeling that she couldn't communicate with you all or connect with you all? Or what was it?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think it is. It could have been down to embarrassment, and maybe she felt that she wasn't best equipped to give us that education. But at the same time, I just felt snubbed that I'm preparing for a GCSE, yet she's handing over a workbook and telling us a huge part of your curriculum you have to learn yourself and I'm not going to teach you.
And the last caller who was on there was suggesting that, you know, children are not naive these days. And he was basically saying, you know, because of the access of to pornography through the internet and the society that we're currently in, children understand sex and understand all of the issues around it. He was actually talking about 12-year-olds understanding it. What's your view?
Well, I think if you don't teach your children about sex, and they're going to learn it from other sources, and pornography is not a good source for a child to learn about sex, especially when it comes to normal sex and relationships and sex and connection. What you see in pornography is not indicative of real life sex. And now we have a generation of kids who are set up with these high expectations and sexual behaviours that are dangerous. So if you actually had educators who could guide children through that, they'd be much better equipped whenever they're grown up.
And finally, Orla, in terms of the different political positions that we've heard laid out this morning, do you support the DUP who say that they want schools and boards of governors to have the freedom to decide what appropriate sex education is? Or do you agree with the Alliance Party who want it standardised?
It should be standardised, because I feel if you allow it to be up to the schools and the individual educators, then some children are going to be given a massive injustice and a massive disservice to their education.
Okay. Thanks for coming on this morning. Thanks for calling us, Orla. Thanks a lot. Morning to you. Big issue this. Very reactive. 030-30-80-55-55. Next up, the People Before Profit MLA, Jerry Carroll,
wants free car parking in hospitals to be brought forward a lot sooner. We remember this being discussed. It was to come in, and it was to come in very quickly, wasn't it? Then it was delayed for 2 years because of money. How can we afford this? Jerry Carroll wants the time limit before this comes in to be delayed to just 4 months now. How are we going to afford that, Jerry?
Morning, Stephen. Well, I mean, this was obviously voted through by parties and MLAs almost 2 years ago now. Every party, if memory serves me correct, voted through it, and many of those parties actually stood on an election manifesto to say, we brought you free parking charges, and now most of them, pretty much all of them, are rolling back on that. So basically our point is that these charges are a tax, a further tax on health workers who have already seen their wages cut year on year. They're a tax on the sick as well, and the Minister and his executive colleagues want to roll back on promises and votes they already committed to 2 years ago.
Well, Robin Swan has said, the Health Minister Robin Swan has said, this was down to practical obstacles with a scheduled date and also deepening budgetary pressures. So the question remains, how are we going to afford it?
Yeah, well, 2 points. The Minister said technical issues in the debate last week. We challenged that, but we voted against the Minister's decision, but obviously the vote went through. So the Minister said the technical set of things should be ready by September, so our amendment is to bring forward free parking in September. And just the final point on affordability, Stephen, I think I've said this in your show before, the Health Trust spend £400 million on private agency firms. So they're telling us they can't afford £6 million in parking charges they received last year, but they can't afford to spend £400 million subsidising and going to private agency firms. So I don't buy it, and many people out there wouldn't buy it either.
Well, Michelle O'Neill has said this would be a blow to the public, but the executive had no choice but to support the proposal. Hospital car parking charges generate about £10 million each year. Matthew Robinson, Northern Ireland Conservatives, can we really not afford that? £10 million in that massive budget that the health service have?
Good morning, Stephen. I think first and foremost, what should be prioritised is the safety of patients and anybody that visits any of our health and social care trust sites across Northern Ireland. And the HSEs have come out and said that they have legitimate concerns that costing aside, that the infrastructure is not in place, the automatic number plate recognition systems are not in place, and they had legitimate safety concerns for patients, for staff, if this was going to be rushed. I think the minister is right here. I don't think this should be a party political issue. He's not talking about scrapping the proposed plan. I think most people can support it. He's talking about pushing it back and ensuring a safe an organised rollout.
That's not just what he's saying. He's talking about budget pressures as well. So yeah, when's it ever going to be affordable?
Well, there needs to be a political reality. When this legislation got royal assent, no one could have been predicted that the Northern Ireland Executive and Assembly was going to collapse and effectively be on autopilot. We haven't had the proper time to be able to put these systems in place. I think we owe it to all our health and social care trusts that are under incredible strain, that if something like this is going to be rolled out, it's going to be rolled out with proper organisation and sustainable finance.
But we don't know that, do we? Because if the infrastructure isn't there at the moment, that's one argument. But if it's not affordable now, it's completely reasonable of me to ask, how is it going to be affordable anytime?
Well, this is where you get, I think, to the real pressing issue. Our health and social care system is at its knees. It needs radical reform. Bengoa laid it out for us not that long back in October 2016. This has been collecting dust. And rather than fixating on what are relatively small issues and small amounts of spending, I would suggest MLAs, with respect to Jerry Carroll, should be focusing on serious reforms, to our health and social care trust, not trying to tweak around on the edges on a relatively small issue like this.
Jerry, how are you going to stop people parking in the hospital and tooting into town? For their shopping, for their work, whatever. So if it's free car parking, how do you know that people are using the car parking for the hospital?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's been used by the minister and some of the health officials over the last 2 years. And my constituency office is right next to the Royal Victoria Hospital, and I live quite close to it, and I don't believe or see any evidence, and I don't think the officials have any evidence that people are parking in the Royal to go to another place.
Sorry, you can't see any evidence because it's not free. At the point at which it was free, how do you stop them? What's your thinking around how you stop them?
But in terms of the evidence, I mean the departments and the trust haven't done any data collection to say that people are parking in the Royal Hospital, for example, to go to another place of work. There's no evidence that it's happening now, so that's the point I'm making.
But there's a charge now, isn't there?
Yeah, but there's no evidence that people are parking there.
But if
there
it were free, well, why wouldn't someone...
Well, where are they going to come from? Let's use the example of the Royal Victoria Hospital. It's the biggest employer in West Belfast. The majority of people parking there or working there, or they're patients, or they've got family members who are patients. So are they going to park there for free to go to what other workplace? They walk 15, 20 minutes into the city centre.
Yeah.
I don't see it.
You don't see it?
Some one or two might, but I think it's a red herring from the department, I think, Frank. And just to take a point about Matthew said this is a small issue. I mean, we heard in the debate last week that some health workers are paying £150 a month. £150 a month to park at their place of work. That's not a small issue. That's a massive issue. All the conversations about retention and keeping healthcare workers in the service and their unions, their representative organisations, have been against this extra charge, extra tax from day one. So it's very much a major issue and in some ways connected to the wider problems of our health service.
Mick Fieldy is the editor of Sligo Tool. Well, Mick, it cannot be afforded is the bottom line from the government.
Well, I mean, look, I don't know how that calculation can be made until we see a budget, because the budget is the thing that lays out where all the where all the expenditure has to be. I mean, I think Jerry made the point. It's a relatively small point in the budget, and actually it's that larger piece that we're all kind of waiting on to see whether all the major parties who are in government, obviously Jerry's isn't, SDLP's isn't, who've all promised to put this laser focus on health. That's what's been promised. Robin Swan by all his colleagues, and you know, there is a, you know, I mean, the GP service is flat on its face. You know, the waiting times, the accident emergency, all of that stuff. There's a huge amount of money to be found, but we haven't had the last budget we had was 2016, 2017. So these guys really need to start anteing up and telling us what we can, showing us what we can and what we cannot afford.
Why haven't they?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. It's now 2024, and as I say, the last budget was 2016, 2017. They're supposed to be setting this for 3 years. And I just think the gap between the parties is enormous on all of this stuff, and each one of them has their own pet projects that they want to see funded first. Unfortunately... They don't have a good record when it comes to, political cooperation, because that requires each one of them to make a sacrifice in areas that are important to their own support. Although you would have thought for most people in Northern Ireland by now, rescuing the health service really ought to be something that they could all agree on and get across the line.
But rescuing the health service, it takes very little time to actually say that, Mick, and a long time to do it, as you know.
Yeah. Well, I think it's been, Ben Goh has been mentioned There have been I think, 5 major reports over the last 25 years that have laid it all out. And apparently, we heard from Michelle O'Neill when she was health minister back in 2016 that this was the plan. I think, if I remember correctly, the line was, you know, within 10 years, if we don't act on this now, the health budget will take up something like 90% of the whole of the budget space back in 2016. And what's happened since then? We've had walkouts, we've had boycotts, we've had absolutely nothing. So we're not even starting from zero. We're starting from way back on zero. And it's the failure, I think, of these major parties to really grasp the policy nettle and take seriously things that seriously affect ordinary people in Northern Ireland. And that's the, you know, and they have forsaken it for tribal towns.
McFeely, thank you. Jerry, thank you for coming on this morning. Thank you very much indeed, Matthew.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far.
So there you are, you're in the airport and you're thinking of this lovely holiday that you've had, and you've got your wee carry-on case and you stick it into the wee cage that the airlines have. Now, that case has always fitted in their wee cage. And you're stuffing it in. And it's inches out. And for some reason, you've got this thing about tape measures. And you always carry a tape measure. You get your wee tape measure out. And you say, this cage is not the same size that it has always been. This is the scandal that the Nolan Show is now investigating. Has EasyJet got a luggage measurement cage that is bust, that is fining people for oversized luggage when it's not the case? Well, we don't know. EasyJet say they are now investigating after Denise contacted the Nolan Show about how her recent travels with EasyJet had become a bit of a farce. Let's have a listen.
Well, I was travelling last Monday from Southampton to Belfast, or so I hoped. Our flight was cancelled by EasyJet. We were transferred to London Gatwick for a flight 7 hours later. Whenever I was
7 hours later?
Yes.
Oh, what a nightmare.
It wasn't pleasant.
My goodness, okay.
So whenever I bought a new suitcase at Christmas time specifically to travel light with EasyJet. And whenever I've gone travelled earlier on this year, my suitcase has been put in the slot with absolutely no problem.
Yes.
Whenever we entered into gate 55C at Gatwick, and I waited just until the very last to get on the flight, didn't want to be pushing through everybody, and whenever I was directed to put my bag into the slot, my bag wouldn't fit.
So this is this wee metal cage thing they have now.
That's
where they're making sure that your bag isn't an inch or two over.
Is exactly right. My bag fitted absolutely perfectly 8 or 9 times earlier on this year, and then suddenly in Gatwick Gate 55C it didn't fit. And luckily enough,
reduced the size of their slot, had they?
They had indeed. I had a tape measure with me, Stephen, and I got the tape measure out and I measured the opening now at the top.
You did not?
Yes, I did. And instead of it being just over 45 centimetres, it was now 42 centimetres.
Which airline was this?
This was EasyJet.
So are you suggesting that some EasyJet cages are different sizes than the others?
I'm not suggesting it, Stephen. I'm telling you it's an absolute fact. I had a tape measure there. I only wish now with hindsight that I videoed it or took a picture, but I'm afraid, as I say, we were maybe the last 3 or 4 people to get on the flight. The only reason why I was able to get my bag into the slot is because another gentleman was trying desperately to get his bag in, and his bag really was a tight fit, to be fair, obviously with it being 3 centimetres smaller. But there were 2 metal bars, so to speak, at the top of the cage that reduced the width. And whenever he was pulling his bag out, he dislodged one of them.
Ooh.
And it was only for that reason yes. that I would be able to get my bag into so the slot.
You must have taken on the staff then, or that's the wrong terminology. You must have questioned the staff and said, look, what's going on here?
Of course I did. But Stephen, you know what it's like these days whenever you question anybody about anything. They say, oh, you're abusing me or whatever. I asked the girl, I said, excuse me, how can this be fair? You've reduced the sizes of this cage. It's 42 centimetres. It should be 45 centimetres. This is not right. And she said, nothing to do with me. Take it up with EasyJet. I looked at her and I said, sorry, you're wearing an EasyJet uniform. You have an EasyJet lanyard around your neck. Are you not EasyJet? I'm not EasyJet customer services. And I said, give me their telephone number then. Oh, you don't contact them that way. You'll have to contact them via email. And of course, how am I going to contact EasyJet customer services whenever the flight's closing, you know, in 1 minute in order to get on the flight, onto the aircraft? I would have had to have paid for the money had that gentleman not dislodged the bit of metal at the top of the cage.
What were you doing running around with a tape measure?
I always carry a tape measure.
What?
Specifically for these reasons.
Oh, come on.
All of those reasons.
You keep a tape measure. You don't carry it every day. You take it when you're flying.
No, Stephen, no. It's a paper tape measure I got in TK Maxx or Dunelm, and I carry it, and it's an absolute lifesaver, especially when you're shopping.
You carry it every day?
Yes. I was a girl guide, what can I say? The motto is, be prepared.
I can barely get out with clothes on in the morning, and you've got a tape measure with you every single day, just in case.
In 3 or 4 bags as well, Stephen, and also in the car.
My goodness.
Never get caught out.
Well, look, we will inquire of EasyJet if they have reduced the size of their slots without telling us.
Well, I mean, I checked the website specifically for the sizes in case they had decreased the sizes and didn't actually let us know. But no, it's still being advertised at, I think it's 45, 36, 25, I think, are their measurements.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, this was clearly 42 centimetres and my bag would not have gone in had that other gentleman not dislodged the bar atop. But my point is this, Stephen, I am sure that there must have been, I don't know how many the aircraft holds, but the aircraft was absolutely full that day. So I'm certain that there were lots of other people who had the requisite size of hand luggage and were caught out by that day, and I'm sure that EasyJet made an absolute clean fortune.
Let us suss it out. Will you do that for us? Give us a bit of time.
Certainly.
Thanks very much. Thanks for talking to us today.
They say, come fly with me, let's fly, let's fly. Pack up, let's fly.
EasyJet say we clearly inform customers of maximum cabin bag dimensions when booking. Our ground crew must ensure the customer's cabin bags are within the maximum dimensions to safely and securely fit where they need to be stowed in the cabin, and so customers will sometimes be asked to check this using our baggage side gauges in the airport. Isn't it interesting EasyJet just don't talk in that statement about money? They charge people if you're over. We take complaints of this kind seriously, say EasyJet, and are working with our ground handling provider to investigate what may have happened in this case. They've said they are looking into whether a damaged bag sizer may have been used in this instance. Now, I think we might have a second Vinny on our hands in the Nolan Show behind the scenes. I remember many, many years ago, Vinny was always saying to me, can I come on air? Can I come into the studio? Now look at that man. He thinks he's greater than me.
Well, I'm a very different person than Vinnie Hurl.
Hello, Brendan. Hello. How are you? What are you saying about Vinnie?
Not saying anything.
So what story do you want to bore us with?
Oh, well, do you know what? This brings back memories, this EG.
Oh, not too long a memory.
Well, not too long, okay. Well, fair enough. But a couple of years ago, I had a similar situation.
He loves being on camera, Brendan. You might notice this in Nolan Live. Well, there's more of him on camera than anybody he's reporting on.
That's not true, and you know it. But a couple of years ago, I had a similar situation, actually, where I held up a plane. I was waiting to get on the plane, and similar situation. Now, I had went from Belfast to London. Belfast, there was no issue. I then came back, and they tried to charge me for my bag. So,
were you trying to fit it in the wee sizer?
I was trying to fit it into the wee sizer. Now, I didn't have a measuring tape. That was the only thing I didn't have.
Why didn't it fit?
Well, it didn't fit because it was too big. It was just too thick for the cage. And
it was the same case.
It was the same case, and it wouldn't go in. But that wasn't the issue, because when I went from Belfast,
had you duty free cigarettes packed into this case?
I don't smoke, so I didn't have duty.
Had you handcuffs and chains in this case?
There was no handcuffs or chains in my bag. I can confirm that on air this morning. But basically,
apparently that did happen to Vinny one time.
Well,
I'm serious. So I'm not winding this up. True story. Vinny Hurl had chains and handcuffs in his case, and they opened it.
Why does that not surprise me?
There was a bit of context around that story. I'll just leave the context out.
Well, I mean, I had no chains, I had no handcuffs, I can confirm that.
I think I might have exaggerated the handcuffs bit. Anyway, so what happened?
Well, basically, I held the flight up, and I remember this guy with a clipboard came running up, and he's like, you know, this plane needs to go now. Are you getting on the flight or you not? Now, long story short, I had to pay for the extra bag. However, I got it back.
Did you?
I did.
What was wrong with the resizer?
They're basically, they never said what was wrong with it, but they, you know, the long story, the moral of the story was that they didn't measure my bag going over, but coming back, they were like, actually, we need to measure this bag. And apparently it was too big for the cage. But I did pay for it.
So why'd they give you your money back if your bag was too big?
Well, I made the argument that they didn't ask for money going over, and they said, okay, fair enough. So,
all right. Thank you very much, Brendan.
Well, just to confirm, there was no handcuffs or no chains in that bag.
Thank you very much indeed. Mr. Hurl denies it too. Thank you. Good morning, Norman. Good morning, Norman.
Morning, Stephen. Baba, black sheep, have you any wool?
Yes, I've put this out. I've put this out in my Twitter feed.
Yes, so, I hear you have sheep in your lawn.
I was lying in bed this morning, right? And I don't know if it's a sign of getting old, but I'm waking up earlier now. So it was 6 o'clock this morning down at Fantasy Island, and I'm lying there. And I hear all the windows getting banged, like really, really loud bang on lots of the windows.
Right.
And I'm thinking to myself, my alarms are going to go off in a minute and the police are going to be here. And I thought to myself, am I dreaming? Am I fully awake? And I was fully awake. I thought to myself, I can't be bothered getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning.
So the sheep got you up?
So, no. So then the banging got harder and harder. And I still didn't get up. I couldn't be bothered. I thought to myself, if this is a raid of some description, I'm not getting up. So I led there and I looked out, and then there was this ugly big face staring at me through my bedroom window. I have now published this on Twitter at Stephen Nolan. So I jumped up, and it's this big sheep right at my, you can see this in the photograph, have a look at it, at Stephen Nolan, where the sheep, there's about 7 or 8 of them.
Well, have you not got a fanter in your garden?
Yes. But the stupid builder had left my gates open this morning.
Well, then you'll have to get a sheepdog to get them out, round them up.
So here's the interesting thing. Now, I was in my pants, right? So I had clothes on. And I walked then out onto the driveway to chase them. And I ran towards them. And they stood their ground and didn't flinch. So I thought to myself, these things are going to come after me. So I ran away. I ran back into the house.
Away from sheep?
Do sheep charge you?
No. You should be able to round them up and push them out the gate.
I think this might have been a ram. It was a big thing that just stirred me out. And I took the willies and ran away.
Look at the money you could make. You share them all, Stephen, get all the wool off and sell the wool.
There's a clip. So do sheep storm you?
No, sheep will run away from you. So they will.
Right.
So all you have to do is round them up and usher them out through the gate. I'll get yourself a sheepdog and round them up.
But why would these things not, why do they not run away from me then?
Well, they must have fancied you, Stephen. There's plenty of meat on you. We'll stand here and he'll look at the welfare he is. He'll maybe feed us.
Now, here's the interesting part. And again, no word of a lie. I promise you this happened this morning, right? So I ran back into the house And I'm now standing looking through the window at these sheep for about 5-10 minutes as they trampled all over my lawn. Right?
Right.
And there was a wee baby sheep. And the wee baby sheep was skipping along. And ever so often, he would jump up and do a wee skip.
Well, you see, if you'd have got the hold of the baby sheep and put them out through the gate, the rest probably would have followed.
But here's the point. I cannot believe I'm saying this. But when I saw that baby sheep skipping along, the lamb.
Yes, it's a lamb in season.
Well, they're just trying to be funny behind the glass here. I know what's called a lamb. It's a baby sheep to me. So do you know what I thought to myself? I thought to myself, I eat that. And I wondered, it's the first time in my life I've thought, should I become a vegetarian? Not that ugly big ram. I would eat that all day long. But that wee baby sheep.
My lamb chops.
So I understand now why people become vegetarians. It was beautiful. As it was skipping along, pooing on my lamb, it was still beautiful.
I look at the lamb chops. You could have had with all them sheep there.
I know. Anyway, how are you doing?
All right, Stephen.
Good.
See you in Santa Monica.
Yes, I was there. I was there a week or so ago.
You're becoming like James Cagney, Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Oh, I love it over there. I love it over there. Listen, thank you, Norman. All the best.
All the best, Stephen.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Norman's a founder member to The Nolan Show. He's been with us over 20 years. I'm in the BBC 20 years this year. He was with us in City Beat. That man must be listening to me about 25 years. My goodness. Who would inflict that on anyone? Jack, good morning, Jack.
Morning, Stephen. How are you doing?
Doing all right, thank you. Back to the EasyJet story.
Yeah, I was just driving in to work there and I heard a story on the show and I was there in person. My son and I were coming back from London last Monday.
You were there with this lady's event?
Yeah, I witnessed it all and I thought I would phone in to give her some corroboration because it sounds too good to be true. But everything that she said happened.
So you saw her getting her wee measure tape out? And...
Yeah, because there's a gentleman ahead of her and he must have size 12 feet because the shoes were sticking out of the bag and he couldn't get his bag in.
It's ridiculous.
He was wrestling with a sizer and then this lady came along and she couldn't get hers in either. My son and myself were just waiting until the end. And we are witnessing all this, but when we saw her get her tape measure out, it was a scream. It was hilarious. It was brilliant.
I know. I'm sorry. It shouldn't be funny, but it is, isn't it?
It was brilliant, and she won the day. I mean, it's not often you get one over an EasyJet, and I took some personal satisfaction out of it because the year previous, I was caught going over with two bags and he hit me for 88 quid on the way over and 88 quid on the way back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So when I saw the wee soft tape measure coming out, you know, like the ones that you would get measured up for a suit with, and then they let her go on, it was brilliant vindication. I thought, I have to corroborate this story because it's 100% true.
And she was bent down, was she, measuring the exact inch of the sizer?
She was measuring the sizer and then quoting the differential between what was online and what the actual size of the sizer was. It was priceless.
And EasyJet are now telling us that they're investigating whether that particular sizer was bust.
Yeah, and the audacity, these are the passengers who had just been delayed for 8 or 9 hours. Bust from Southampton to Gatwick, yet they were looking to charge them more money over a couple of centimetres and a defective sizer, you know.
They must make a fortune over. Look, I was coming back there what 3-4 days ago, and I was flying. Where was I flying out of? Where was I flying out of? I was flying from Los Angeles to Vegas. One of these internal airlines.
Yeah.
I put my bag on the weigh machine. The wee man said, "You're 5 kilos over." And I thought, am I? So we started, I opened, there was a big queue behind me. I opened the case and I was piling all of my clothes out of this case.
You had 3 coats on?
Yeah, I was taking them all out. And I carried them on. I carried them through security then before I'd give him 100 quid he wanted for that luggage. Yeah. All right, mate. Listen, thank you for calling us. Good story.
All right, Stephen. All the best. Bye.
We'll end today with Donald Trump, his criminal trial. Could President Trump end up, former President Trump, in jail? Unlikely. But let's get across this story with US political analyst Eric Hamm, who told me more about the background of the alleged hush money payments to Stormy Daniels.
Well, this case actually goes all the way back to the 2016 presidential election, where it's been alleged that Donald Trump paid what is known as hush money to an adult film star that he had an affair with. And the crux of the crime is that he actually falsified business records when actually making this payment so as to not allow it to become public that he'd had this relationship during an election so as not to interfere with his chances of winning that election. Now, we know that his one-time lawyer, Michael Cohen, actually pled guilty to federal crimes relating to this hush money payment, and he actually went to prison for that. Now what we see is the Manhattan District Attorney, which is a local jurisdiction, they've actually brought charges against Donald Trump for this particular crime.
And what Trump is going to say, I was reading about what some of his attorney has been saying last night. They're saying, look, if you're going to rely on the Cohen evidence, the Michael Cohen, his former lawyer's evidence, that's a convicted liar.
That's right. And we know from their opening statement that they are going to make their case all about Michael Cohen. And while they're certainly correct, and Michael Cohen is sullied in so many different ways, he is someone who actually went to prison for this crime. But also, more importantly, we know, at least from his testimony, his public testimony before the U.S. Congress, that he actually has receipts for his involvement in this conspiracy of actual reimbursed checks from Donald Trump regarding payments to the adult film star.
In one of the conversations at the time between Cohen and Trump when they were friendly, Cohen recorded it, didn't he?
He did. He actually had recordings that he used, as well as the actual reimbursed checks. And so I'm pretty sure all of this information is going to come out during this trial. And it'll be interesting to see how Donald Trump's lawyers use the actual evidence to rebut Michael Cohen. Because as we say, and as we know, Michael Cohen certainly has a very sordid reputation. But one thing that will be very, very difficult to disprove and dispute is the actual evidence of these payments. And of course, a lot of this is going to go to what Donald Trump's state of mind is when all of this allegedly took place.
And Trump is denying ever having had an affair even with Stormy Daniels.
Oh, most certainly. And also we know that rebut that as well, we know that they're also going to bring to the stand Karen McDougal, the former Playboy playmate who had an affair with Donald Trump for over a year. And we know that there was also a $150,000 payment to her and to actually tell her story. And that was part of this catch and kill. And we're going to hear more about that from the former CEO of the National Enquirer today when he's back on the stand.
Catch and kill essentially means a publication buying a story, buying the rights to the story, and then killing the story by not printing it.
Exactly. And so there's going to be these stories here that will show a pattern, not just as it relates to Stormy Daniels, the adult film star, but how this happened on other occasions as well. And it's going to be, again, it's also interesting because we know yesterday in the opening statement by the defense, they talked about Donald Trump as this family man. And so we are going to see where just how that, again, the credibility, not only of Donald Trump, but of the defense is going to really be put to the test here when this information comes out about these alleged trysts and affairs that Donald Trump had, which, again, goes to the heart of this story, this narrative that the defense is attempting to showcase to the jury about who Donald Trump is.
Eric, if, and it is an if he is found guilty, could there be a situation, and if he wins the election, two big ifs. Could you have a sitting American president in jail?
Well, if Donald Trump is convicted in this case, I think it will be highly unlikely that he will actually get any jail time. In the Manhattan court system, Donald Trump is facing 34 felonies, but these are what are known as E-felonies. So in New York, their felonies are broken down from A through E, A being the worst type of felony, E being the least worrisome type of felony, if you will. And if Donald Trump is convicted, typically what happens is he would be seen as a first-time offender. And because of who he is, there would be unlikely that he would actually get jail time as a result of being found guilty. In fact, many legal experts do not believe he will get any jail time. He will just be guilty of a felony in this case and may have to pay a large fine.
And finally, today, the judge in his trial will hear arguments that whether he breached an order which prevents him commenting on witnesses and jurors.
That's right. We know that the prosecution believes that Donald Trump actually violated the gag order that was put in place by the judge, and they believe that he violated it at least 10 times already. And so what they're asking for is a fine of $1,000 for each time that he violated the gag order. So they're going to be looking for a minimum of $10,000 from Donald Trump as a result of him violating the gag order. And then, of course, a warning that if in fact he does it again, that there could be an even stiffer or harsher penalty, perhaps even jail time.
Eric, thank you very much for your time this morning. Thank you, sir.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
That's it from us for today. I'm away down to get the sheep out of my house. Lots of you contacting us about these bag size things for airlines. We'll follow that up for tomorrow, and we'll see you in the morning at 9 o'clock. Thanks a lot, everyone, as usual, for your company. Have a nice day.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan.
Ich bin Lea.
Ich bin Lina und wir machen den Podcast Juice.
Das hier ist Juice und da erzählen wir uns gegenseitig jede Woche eine juicy Geschichte aus der Community. Egal, ob die jetzt schockierend, peinlich oder einfach nur funny ist.
Zum Beispiel die Geschichte über Raphael, der eine Hodenkrankheit vortäuscht, nur um sein Date im Krankenhaus zu besuchen.
Die Ärztin so, naja, können wir den Hoden auch antackern.
Hört Juice überall, wo es Podcasts gibt. Wir freuen uns.
It's spicy, you tell me, yeah.